on consumer protection and government efficiency. Colleagues and members of the audience, we have two bills up today. We will be hearing Senate Bill 814 first, and before we get to Senate Bill 254A. So with that, I am going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 814. Bob, give us a brief description of Senate Bill 814. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 814 expands the Oregon Environmental Cleanup Assistance Act by providing a private right of action for unfair environmental claims settlement practices, requiring coverage of damage to third-party property and expenses to mitigate damage, and establishing a right to independent counsel and environmental consultants provided by the insurer in certain circumstances.
Thank you. And Senator, we're going to have you go first and introduce this bill as you're the chief sponsor. So welcome to the committee, and if you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson, and I have the privilege of representing Senate District 16, which now includes parts of Portland's working waterfront, and ergo my interest in this issue. Senator Shields is a co-chief on this, and I don't know if he's going to testify as well.
We're not expecting him today.
Okay, cool. Well, then I'll just soldier ahead.
Thank you.
It is an honor to represent the thousands of hardworking men and women who are employed in the harbor zone, as well as the businesses, large and small, that employ them. The Portland Harbor Superfund cleanup is of great interest to my constituents, and at a price tag expected to exceed $1 billion, I think it should be of great interest to the legislature, frankly, the whole state of Oregon. This is precisely the type of issues that good Oregon companies were protecting against when they bought insurance policies sometimes a number of years ago. In exchange for insurance protection, these entities faithfully paid their contractually obligated insurance policy premiums for years. And so now, at a time when the harbor and the business community calls upon those policies, it appears that insurance companies have been reticent to pay out. Allegations include not responding to claims of tender for months and months, if not years in some cases, hoping, I guess, that the policyholders will give up and run out of money to fight the good fight. In some instances, allegations of hiring inexperienced counsel to defend complex environmental litigation suits because it's less expensive. And there have been allegations of companies threatening fellow insurance companies covering the same loss, that if one company settles, they may be liable for contribution suits later. And obviously, this results in more delays and more cost to policyholders. So this is a problem that exists for big and small companies. I think we need this bill to ensure that companies are able to do what's right, clean up the environment using insurance coverage that they thought was in existence, that they paid for with the expectation of coverage. We also need this bill so that the Superfund cleanup occurs as soon as possible. And I think that at the end of the day, you can say this is a jobs bill, because once the cleanup occurs, that's going to allow for new business development in the harbor, and that has got to be good for Oregon's economy. So to be clear, this bill applies statewide to all insurance where DEQ and EPA issues an enforcement action and insurance is at issue. There are many more capable people than I to speak of some of the details of the bill, but let me just hit a few of the high points. It's going to allow for the assignment of environmental claims. It's going to provide that non-accumulation clauses will not be construed to apply to long-tailed environmental claims. These are claims that are covered by multiple policies. That fact will serve to limit the opportunity for a later insurer to receive a windfall because an earlier policy covered a continuing loss. The bill will protect third-party property by clarifying when insurers must respond to claims that hazardous substances have damaged the property of the state or another third party. I give you an example. In many cases, the property of the state of Oregon, is the bed and banks of the river, the groundwater, and the surface water. Regrettably, environmental pollution doesn't follow property lines, and the insurance company's obligations to pay costs for which the insured is liable shouldn't either. I think it's going to clarify that an insurer has an obligation to pay all, that an insurer that has an obligation to pay all sums may not fail to make payments to the insured on the grounds that any other insurer has not made payment. It'll encourage claim settlement by encouraging an insurer to enter into good faith settlement of environmental claims. It'll provide a definition for unfair environmental claims, settlement practices, a private right of action, as the professional staff has already explained, and a non-binding environmental claim mediation program. And finally, it requires the insured to bring experienced counsel to the table, not only experienced legal counsel, but experienced environmental consultants, and to pay their customary and regular rates so that an issue as complex as the cleanup of the Portland Harbor is done by, to use a kind of slangy colloquial phrase, the A-team. This is complex stuff, and I think that it calls on the highest standard of professionalism. So, colleagues, the statute was originally enacted in 1999. Changes were made in 2003, and we're back here again making more changes if this bill is successful, in an effort to be responsive to the businesses and local governments in the Portland Harbor who are desperately in need of clarity and will benefit from the provision of Senate Bill 814. I think it's a jobs bill. I hope you give thoughtful consideration to its passage. And again, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I thank you for your courtesy in allowing me to appear by telephone.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. That was a very good introduction to the bill that's in front of us. And would you like to take a question or two, if there are any, or are you?
I think there are going to be much more learned folks after me. So if it gets too technical, I'm going to defer to the certified smart guys that I think are going to testify behind me.
And we certainly do have a sign-up sheet with a number of individuals on it. Committee, questions for Senator Johnson? Looks like we're all ears at this point, Senator, and I appreciate you bringing the bill forward, and thank you very much. You can either stay on the line or get back to your hectic schedule.
I'm actually going to excuse myself, and I'm going to rejoin my own Ways and Means sub that has been accommodating my telephonic participation. And so, again, with an expression of appreciation to the chair and the committee, I'm going to ring off. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
So, committee, up first on our sign-up sheet, we have Jennifer Hudson, Joan Snyder, and Jessica Hamilton. Do they want to all come up together, or just the two? Or? And a new seat for you in the committee room.
Yes, Chair Holvey, so nice of you to notice. I've been sitting in many seats and finally graduated to the big table. Thank you for noticing. For the record, my name's Jennifer Hudson. I'm here today on behalf of my employer, Schnitzer Steel. We are a publicly traded metal recycling company headquartered in Portland, Oregon. We have 3,600 employees in North America, spanning 16 states, Western Canada, and Puerto Rico. Founded in 1906 by Sam Schnitzer, our company has deep roots in Oregon. With operations in Bend, White City, Eugene, McMinnville, and Portland, we consider the state of Oregon to be our home as well as our headquarters. As an Oregon business, Schnitzer Steel is committed to providing family wage manufacturing jobs. We also appreciate the value of a high quality of life in attracting and retaining employees. Senate Bill 814, relating specifically to insurance for environmental claims, is an important piece of legislation to Schnitzer Steel. Senate Bill 814 seeks to improve on the reforms for environmental claims passed by the legislature in 1999 and 2003. This bill is necessary to build on existing statutes in an effort to further remedy the challenges that businesses face in Oregon when we tender an environmental claim with our insurance companies. Despite the previous reforms made by the legislature a decade ago, our Oregon experience with environmental claims continues to be one marred by insurance company delays, excuses, and avoidance. Why now, you might ask? Two words, Portland Harbor. Senator Johnson did a good job of summing that up, but the timing of the expected Portland Harbor Superfund cleanup illustrates exactly why passage of Senate Bill 814 is so important this session. EPA expects to choose a remedy for Portland Harbor by the end of 2014. It will then turn to the potentially responsible parties, of which Schnitzer Steel is one, along with another 140 small and large businesses, including public entities like the Port of Portland and the City of Portland. EPA will direct us to enter into consent agreements to implement the directed remedy and to start paying for it. Many of those entities have insurance that provides coverage for these types of claims, and that is a very good thing. However, if what is happening with environmental insurance claims in Oregon does not change, the cleanup could drag on for years. This is because, rather than paying the claims, many insurers are making the policyholders take them to court in order to make them pay. Litigation causes years, 5 to 10 years, even more in some cases, of delay before the claims are paid out. And for policyholders who do not have the resources to mount a lawsuit against their insurers, it is causing them to give up their claims or settle for a payment far less than what is owed. If that same process plays out in Portland Harbor, the EPA will select its remedy in 2014, and many of the liable parties will not have money to pay for it until 2019 or even 2024. Meanwhile, Portland Harbor will not be cleaned up, and business development in the harbor will continue to be stifled due to the label of a Superfund site. Policyholders should not have to sue their insurance companies. The essence of SB 814 is to cut down this time delay by providing greater certainty and clarity on what the law is that will apply to environmental insurance claims. With this law in place, there will be less that is unclear and, therefore, less litigation. Claims will be resolved faster. Some of the provisions of SB 814 were modeled after our neighboring state of Washington. Schnitzer operates in Washington, and our experience with environmental cleanup claims there differs greatly from our experience here. Insurance companies treat policyholders different in Washington, and I mean that in a good way. Thus, we are seeking to restore the balance to environmental claims process in Oregon by making the process rational and workable, as well as to encourage insurance companies to use the process to streamline claims instead of using the process to delay and stall rightful settlements. As a major Oregon exporter and manufacturer, Schnitzer Steel understands the competitive global landscape and the intense pressures that fall onto the shoulders of this legislative body to balance the need for jobs with the need for environmental protection. This bill is good for the environment and the economy. With your permission, I'll now turn it over to our longtime environmental counsel, Joan Snyder of Stoll Reeves, who will walk you through the bill section by section, offering valuable examples to put the proposed changes into context. Thank you.
Chair Holvey and committee members, I am Joan Snyder. I am with the law firm of Stoll Reeves in Portland, and I am here today representing Schnitzer Steel Industries, Inc. I am here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 814. As Senator Johnson explained, this bill provides an update to the existing Oregon Environmental Cleanup Assistance Act, which is in the statutes at ORS 465.479. It is a narrow bill that, like the existing act, will only apply to environmental insurance claims. Further, because of the way that environmental insurance policies have been written, it primarily applies to policies that were written prior to 1986, because that's the last year in which standard liability insurance policies covered environmental claims. Those historic policies are important, though, because they provide insurances to businesses today that discover environmental contamination that was caused many years ago through activities that at the time no one knew or expected or intended could cause harm. Senate Bill 814 will help expedite environmental investigations and cleanups in the state by providing predictability to the outcome of environmental claims under these insurance policies so that businesses themselves don't have to front the cost of cleaning up the contamination when, in fact, it's their insurers who should be paying for it based on the policies that they bought many years ago. The bill will also make sure that the claims are handled fairly. As Senator Johnson explained, this bill is particularly important to Oregon entities, both private and public, in the context of Portland Harbor. But it's also going to be helpful to businesses statewide. I believe that the clerk has passed out my written testimony, and Exhibit A to that is a listing of sites throughout the state where environmental cleanup is necessary and where insurance is involved. So you'll see that there is a large number of cases throughout the state where DEQ wants there to be cleanup, and environmental insurance can play a part in that cleanup. So it is not at all a Portland Harbor-specific issue, although it's important because of that. So with that background, let me move on to explain the provisions of Senate Bill 814. And again, more detail can be found in Exhibit C to my testimony. There are 7 distinct provisions, and I'm going to walk very quickly through each of them, but there is more detail in the written testimony. So the first part of the bill is Section 2, which applies to the assignment of claims. This provides clarity in an area where the Oregon law applicable to environmental claims is unclear. Insurance policies typically provide that the policy cannot be assigned without the insurance company's consent. That makes sense. An insurer who insures a coffee shop doesn't want to suddenly find that they have to honor a policy that's been assigned to someone who operates a nuclear power plant. So it wouldn't make any sense to assign coverage under the policy, but that is not what Section 2 does. Section 2 says that a clause saying that you can't assign the coverage under the policy shouldn't be stretched to apply to assignment of a claim for a payment under the policy. In fact, all that Section 2 does is it does the same kind of assignment that ORS 31825 does now in the context of a tort claim. If there's a settlement of a tort claim, the defendant can assign its claim against its insurance company to the plaintiff. So it is simply an assignment of the claim. Let me give an example. This might help. We're frequently involved in business acquisition deals where the seller has some environmental liabilities, but where they also have insurance that is covering those liabilities. So the seller will disclose to the buyer that there's an environmental claim, that there's a liability that they'll have to respond to, and it also discloses that there's insurance covering the claim. What the buyer wants to know in that circumstance is simply that the insurance will continue to cover the claim, not that the insurance is suddenly going to insure it as a new policyholder, but they will cover the existing claim that already exists. This is traditionally done by the seller assigning the claim to the buyer, just like they assign other contractual rights in the context of the transaction. Nothing has changed in the context of the insurer's risk. Whatever they were going to do in response to the seller's claim, now they're just going to do the same thing, but pay the money to the buyer. If instead the claim evaporated when the seller tried to assign it, then the insurer will have realized a windfall because they were standing ready to pay a claim and suddenly they don't have to pay it. This provision addresses that by saying the claim, not the policy, is assignable. This is consistent with ORS 31825 in the tort context, and it would apply in the same way in the environmental context. I want to stop and make a point here that is going to apply to everything that I say today, and that is that if the insurance policy, and there's many different insurance policies and they say different things, if the insurance policy says clearly that you cannot assign a claim for payment under the policy, then this bill will not do anything to impact that policy. Because there's a saving clause in the existing statute, which will be carried forward in this bill. It's Section 4, Section 8 of the bill, that says that anything in the statute as a rule of construction will only apply if the policy doesn't have clear language saying the parties intended some other effect. So if the policy clearly states the mutual intent of the parties, then the statute is entirely irrelevant. It is only a gap filler when the policy is not clear on a particular issue. Okay, so moving on from the assignment, I want to talk a little bit about the allocation rules under Section 4.2D. This section also provides clarity in an area where existing Oregon law is unclear and where that law needs to match up with the already existing provisions of the Oregon Environmental Cleanup Assistance Act. The issue here is how a non-cumulation clause is applied in the specific context of an environmental claim under the Act. The best way to explain this is by an example. So assume that a policyholder has 4 successive $200 million umbrella liability policies with different insurers. So 4 different years they've bought excess coverage from 4 different insurance companies. That means the policyholder paid significant premiums for those 4 successive years of coverage. Assume there's an environmental claim that triggers all 4 policies, and this frequently happens because the harm to the environment is continuing, so it would trigger all 4 of those policies. In a case like this where a later insurer has a non-cumulation clause, we've seen them argue that only the first policy, i.e. not them, has to pay on the claim, and they will pay nothing to the policyholder just because of the fortuity that there was prior insurance in place. This, of course, subverts the existing provisions of the Oregon Environmental Cleanup Assistance Act, which creates a right of contribution between the between the insurers themselves, that they have to pay those claims pro rata. So you can't have that kind of interpretation of the obligation of the insurance company to the policyholder without subverting the way the Act divides the costs between the insurers themselves. And these clauses are similar to what we call other insurance clauses, where the insurance policies have sometimes said, if you have any other insurance, this insurance doesn't apply. That is an issue that has been squarely resolved by the Oregon courts, and they've said, we're not going to interpret those clauses to mean there isn't coverage to the policyholder. The Lamb Weston case says, if that clause exists in an insurance policy, we won't honor it between the insurer and the policyholder to say there is no coverage, but we will honor it to the extent we can in the context of the contribution claims between the insurers to decide as a matter of equity who should pay. The statute does the same thing in the context of these non-accumulation clauses, the exact same thing that Lamb Weston does in the context of other insurance clauses.
And Ms. Snyder, if you could go through your main points of the remaining parts of your testimony a little quicker, without maybe the examples. We have a lot of other business and people that want to testify, so I'm not trying to hurry you along too much, but it's important stuff. I know.
I'd be happy to, Mr. Chair. And there is written testimony, so you can refer to that,
right,
and we can answer any questions later. So Section 42E applies to remediation to protect third-party property. This also fills a gap in an area where the Oregon Supreme Court has not ruled, has said it has not ruled, and it creates law that fills that gap. It also has one provision that changes Oregon law in one respect to be consistent with the majority of cases in other jurisdictions, to say that even if third-party property is not yet damaged, the actions done on the insured's own property to cut off that pathway are covered. That's the only respect in which it changes Oregon law. The rest of it is filling a gap. There is a provision that applies to excess insurance that codifies the case law or the holdings that have been come out of the majority of the cases in the Oregon courts with respect to how you reach an excess layer of insurance. That's Section 43B. There is a section on settlement. Senator Johnson referred to this, which will make the results of a settlement between a policyholder and an insurance company be much clearer as respect to that insurance company's continuing obligation. That will encourage insurance companies to settle, which will get funding to the policyholders, which means that cleanup will happen faster. There is a provision, Section 6, on the handling and payment of claims, which creates a private cause of action. This is modeled entirely after the statute and rules in the state of Washington, where that process has been available to policyholders, not just for environmental claims, but for all other claims, for over 10 years, or almost over 10, I guess 8 years, and has been working very well. So this bill would only apply that in the context of environmental claims, but it's not inventing anything new. It's doing what they already do in Washington. And finally, Section 7 addresses the issue of independent counsel, which it addresses a narrow conflict of interest problem that arises more frequently in the environmental context than in any other insurance area, where the insured will come in and reserve its rights not to pay a final judgment. So they will hire a lawyer and say, you have to use this lawyer, but oh, by the way, at the end of the day, if there's a judgment against you, we're not agreeing that we're going to pay it. So what this statute says, that in that context, when the insurer reserves its rights and does not take on responsibility to pay the judgment, then they will be required to hire independent counsel. And again, this is not creating something new. It's copied out of what is done in California. It's not even as extensive as the California statute is in creating a right to independent counsel, and creates rules that those counsels need to be qualified counsel competent to handle the kind of claim at stake. I did want to address one other issue. The opponents of Senate Bill 814 have raised arguments that the bill is an unconstitutional impairment of contracts under the state and federal constitutions. I wanted to assure you that this is an issue that legislative counsel addressed in the Senate committee. My written testimony addresses it in more detail. I understand that there is a legal letter authored by Paul DeMunis challenging the constitutionality of the bill. I have thoroughly reviewed that letter, and I disagree with his conclusion. Senate Bill 814 does not impair contracts under either the Oregon or the U.S. Constitution. There is a legal opinion in the written testimony that addresses the issues that have been raised in detail. I would be happy to answer questions the committee has on that issue, but I wanted to assure you that that is addressed.
Thank you. And committee, as you can tell, we have a lot of people to talk, and I really would like to get as much people on the record as we can and perhaps save some of our questions, unless you absolutely think it's necessary, for when we review this bill again. Unless you have a burning question, I know Representative Richardson will.
It's just hard because you don't know if the next panel has the same expertise.
Right. And I qualified it, so if you do.
Okay, one question. Would you mind going into a little bit more detail about the change that would enable coverage to apply to the insured even if there was not a third party that has suffered damage?
So I would be happy to do that, Representative Richardson. The answer is that there is no right in the circumstance that you've described, that there would be a right for coverage when there is no harm to third-party property. What the bill does is it says is if there is harm to third-party property and you have to take some action on your own property in order to prevent the third-party property from being further injured, then it would be covered. That's the only circumstance, and that's actually the issue that was left unresolved by the Snitzer Investment versus Lloyd's London case. Okay. So this fills the gap in that area of law.
Thank you.
Thank you. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Sure. Chairman Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Jessica Hamilton, and I am the General Manager for Harbor Environmental with the Port of Portland. The port was established by the Oregon Legislature in 1891. We have a broad public mission facilitating movement of passengers, freight, and cargo throughout the region for import and export. This impacts every corner of the state. The Port of Portland supports Senate Bill 814. This bill would assist the Port of Portland to facilitate the cleanup and restoration of the Willamette River Superfund site, as well as the Portland International Airport sites. Our goal is to get these sites cleaned up in a timely fashion, consistent with sound environmental cleanup and restoration principles, and in a way that would allow the port to remain financially viable and a resource for our community and competitive with other port authorities on the West Coast. More than 75,000 jobs are tied to the existence of a vital marine port and an international airport serving Northwest Oregon and the Pacific Northwest. More than $14 billion of cargo and more than 14 million passengers flowed through the port last year. Insurance cost recovery remains a key part of our strategy for securing cleanups and restorations and getting those done in a timely and affordable fashion. As you know, the port is a local government as defined in ORS Chapter 174, and we are financially independent of the state. In fact, only 4% of our annual revenue is derived from local property taxes. That means that we rely on business transactions to support our public mission. Whatever we spend on cleanup and restoration efforts divert financial resources from investment in public infrastructure, economic development opportunities, and traded sector job retention and growth. Like many others involved in environmental cleanup, including in the Portland Harbor, the port is looking to its insurance carriers for coverage under policies that we bought many, many years ago that were enforced when the pollution actually occurred. Again, our port was founded in 1891. We've been around for a long time. Over the course of our history, the port has owned common use shipyards to facilitate marine commerce. We've dredged the river for navigation and filled and developed adjacent land for industrial uses.
Hey, Ms. Hamilton, could I ask you to summarize the rest of your testimony? Because we do have your written testimony, and rather than read the whole thing to
sure.
us.
Sure. That is very
fair. I appreciate it.
The bottom line is that we believe that the provisions of 814 will be of great assistance to us. The unfair environmental claim settlement practice prohibitions and associated remedies against insurers that engage in such practices will address the biggest obstacles that the port has to face in securing environmental insurance recovery. And you know, like many of the other businesses that have faithfully paid its premiums with the expectation that this insurance coverage would be around when we needed it, we feel that we are entitled to the benefit of our bargain for those policies. In conclusion, we believe that this legislation not only benefits the port, but it benefits every single Oregon policyholder. It will promote efficient, less costly claims handling practice and make money and resources available for Portland Harbor cleanup as well as the cleanup of other priority sites across the state. And this will help us make sure that our economic assets also remain available to do the work that we engage in public infrastructure. Thank you for hearing this important bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Questions from the committee? Not seeing any. I have one before you leave. I know that in discussing this, the reason you're bringing this forward is that you're not able to satisfy your claims through the current Unclaims Practices Act under the insurance code, and you don't have to answer this now. I'm curious what would House Bill 3160, which is the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, bringing the insurance industry under that, how this overlays with that, and I if it does. And so just something to think about, and you can get back to us later on that.
Sure.
Unless you're prepared to make...
That's not something that I have looked at. I have not looked at that, so no.
Thank
Chair
you.
Holvey, we're not working on that bill.
Yeah, I know you're probably not. I was just wondering if there's potential conflicts or overlap with it. So thank you very much for your testimony. Up next, I'm going to go ahead and call up David Rossmiller and Paul DeMuniz. Good afternoon. If you'd introduce yourself for the records, please.
Good afternoon, Chairman Holvey and members of the committee. I'm David Rossmiller. I'm here representing the American Insurance Association. I'm a partner at the Duncarney Law Firm in Portland.
And you can begin with your
All
testimony
right.
if you'd like.
I sympathize, Chairman Holvey and members of the committee, with your task here because this is very complicated stuff. Insurance is difficult to understand. I've been doing it for a lot of years, and there's a lot of things that are difficult to understand about it. And I think there are some misconceptions about the way this bill would work and what it would do. In reading this bill, and I've read it carefully a number of times, my field is what they call insurance coverage. I deal with insurance disputes and environmental remediation. There's nothing in this bill that is going to speed up this process of cleaning up Portland Harbor. That process is largely set by the regulators, EPA and DEQ, and what that process has, how it's been set up, that is necessarily what is taking so long. Have there been disputes between policyholders and insurers? Yes, they certainly have. But that has nothing to do with the length of the process and the cleanup. That, as you've heard, the remedy has not even been agreed upon or ordered by EPA. Until that happens, cleanup can't even begin. Money can't be paid out by insurers for cleanup until it's known how much it's going to cost and how much and what is supposed to be done. So first off, I disagree that this bill is going to speed up the cleanup of Portland Harbor. Secondly, I think there's also a misconception about what insurers acknowledge they owe. We're talking here about very old insurance policies, as you heard, pre-1986. Those are the only ones that have that so-called limited pollution exclusion in that is interpreted as allowing for coverage of third-party property damage, pollution. Those policies, Chairman Holvey and the committee, those policies, everyone agrees that they have to pay for third-party property damage. If you have pollution on your property and it's getting into state water or a neighbor's property, that has been decided. There's not a dispute any longer under this, and this bill does not change that or alter that. That was decided a long time ago in 1996. In fact, the Supreme Court decided that. So this doesn't introduce some extra money to clean up state waterways or third-party property. Instead, it does something that takes out something that has also been decided definitively by the Supreme Court, the owned property exclusion. You've heard that about that, and that's covered in my written testimony. I hope that I tried to keep it short and understandable, but that's a key feature of liability policies, and that's what we're talking about here. Liability policies, they have always had and they always will have so-called owned property exclusions, because that is covered by property insurance, not liability policies. They don't cover that. What this bill does, it takes those old contracts, 30, 40 years old, and says those exclusions for damage that's only on your property, we're not going to enforce that. Those are key parts of liability policies that I mentioned. They're in every single liability policy there is, always have been and always will be. So that's a very substantial change to policies that were done 40 years ago. It's taking that out. The anti-assignment clause, you've heard that too. That's a key part of liability policies and other policies too. The way the bill is worded, it does not merely address claims. It negates the whole clause. Why is that important? Because that is a fundamental part of an insurance policy. The insurer makes a deal with the person who buys the insurance, given the risk that the insured says they want to cover. Changing that 40 or 50 years after the fact and saying now we're going to take that out and not enforce it, that is a fundamental part of insurance policies that will be negated by this bill. I don't want to get too technical, but I do want to say this on the record. There was talk of ORS 31.825, and that is a statute that deals with the assignment of claims against an insurer. Not applicable. It is not applicable here. When you look at that statute, you see a key difference between that and this is 31.825 applies to judgments. This says you can assign at any time. In addition, the Supreme Court decided after that statute was passed, many years after, in 2006, the Holloway case, the Supreme Court decided that those anti-transfer provisions are enforced as they are stated. So the agreement, it's kind of mystifying here about this savings clause talking about rules of construction or the intent of the parties, because almost every single thing in the bill, the intent of the parties is determined. It has been determined by the Supreme Court in cases. Those rulings can't be overturned by the bill because the court has found, as a matter of fact and law, what the parties already intended. So there's nothing left to interpret on those things. Certainly there could be on some other things, but they aren't in the bill. So the savings clause, talking about rules of construction, doesn't make a lot of sense to me, because these aren't rules of construction. These are substantive parts of the policy that are not going to be enforced because of the bill.
Thank you. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Paul DeMunez. I'm currently a distinguished jurist in residence at Willamette University. I previously was an appellate judge for 10 and a half years on the Court of Appeals. I then was a justice on the Supreme Court and spent 7 years as Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court. A few weeks ago, the Property Casualty Insurers Association of America contacted me and asked me if I would take a look at purported Senate Bill 814 and look at a couple of constitutional issues. I've done that. You have I provided you with a written copy of what my testimony will be today. I'll go very, very fast so that we can move along. Article 1, Section 21 of the Oregon Constitution provides that no law impairing the obligations of contracts shall ever be passed. So that's a directive from those who wrote the Constitution to all of us that we're not supposed to pass a law that impairs a contract. We have said in the Oregon Supreme Court in a case called Hughes versus State, we said ultimately any new law that alters retroactive terms of a contract, i.e., terms of contracts that were in existence before the effective date of the enactment, is unconstitutional insofar as it affects those terms. So that is the established law in Oregon, so you start out with that proposition. By way of background, the Oregon Environmental Cleanup Assistance Act has been in existence since 1999, and the so-called rules of construction have been found in ORS 465.80. There never has been a provision since the statute was enacted. There's never been a provision for retroactive application. That's the new part of this bill that's found in Section 9, I believe, or Section 8, that says this now applies to all existing policies. And as Mr. Rossmiller said, those policies go back before 1986. The question of a party's intent, we have said in the Holloway versus Republic Indemnity case, and this is the law in the state, we have said that we determine, meaning the court, determines the party's intent from the terms and conditions found in the policy. So in the Holloway versus Republic Indemnity case, we said the term, the anti-assignment clause, was enforceable, that it was not ambiguous, and it reflected the intent of the parties. If you go down through the cases, in the Snitzer case, which I've also attached to my testimony, we said how the owned property exclusion clause operates. It reflects the intent of the parties. If you go all the way back to the Ferguson versus Birmingham fire case, which I also attached, we've said that in the insurer controls the litigation, and this would be provision that adds for independent counsel would be contrary to that determination, which goes back many, many years. So I think I'm here to raise the concerns. I'm not on the Supreme Court anymore. Someone else will decide those issues. But if you're looking for a statute that reduces litigation, this would probably not be the statute, because we have decided in Republic versus Holloway, in the Snitzer case, and in the Ferguson case, direct application to three of the provisions in this. And so what I find curious is, if the law is not supposed to apply, we've already said what the party's intent was for those three provisions in those old contracts. So I don't quite, it's hard for me to get my hands around that part of it. I sympathize with the drafters of the statute. It's difficult. I understand what they're trying to do with the savings clause. The question would be whether the Oregon Supreme Court's interpretive methodology would get the drafters where they want to go. I think it's very difficult to call these three provisions, the anti-assignment clause, the owned property exclusion, and the independent counsel provision, very difficult to call those rules of construction. And so if you look, I would urge you to do this. Look at ORS 465.480 as it currently exists. Those are rules of construction. Inserting these provisions that say if you have an anti-assignment clause, it's not enforceable when you've already made a contract, I see that as a substantive provision of law, not as a rule of construction. So I'm here just to raise the concerns that we all should have about whether this will accomplish the goals that the proponents want. The proponents want this to go faster. They want it to go more efficiently. And my question to all of you, if we have so much trouble understanding how this is going to work, particularly given the fact that the Oregon Supreme Court has decided three cases that apply directly to these provisions, I think it makes it very difficult to accomplish that goal. So I wanted to raise that constitutional concern in front of you. Thank you.
Thank you. And I appreciate that, and I think it bears repeating that though you serve very honorably on the Supreme Court, you're not here representing the Supreme Court. And I think that you're not representing Willamette University either.
I just told you where I work.
Yeah, so you're working for property casualty insurers in this instance.
They asked me to prepare an opinion on this, and I did.
Thank
you. That's my written testimony.
And I just have one question that occurred to me, because you visited with me, I was talking to some other people, and I guess there was a case in federal court in the District of Oregon that talked about the retroactivity provision that found that the existing statute with those same provisions was constitutional.
If you're talking about the case, there was one in district court. It had to do with an as-applied challenge, and it had to do with the word suit. It had nothing to do with this that we're talking about now. There's also a case involving anti-assignment clauses that was written by the Ninth Circuit that someone else might be interested in talking about. I've read that also very thoroughly, and they found in that case that the language was ambiguous. The Holloway versus Republic case, the Oregon Supreme Court said a few years ago, those words are not ambiguous. They reflect the intent of the parties. That's the difference.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I couldn't let this opportunity go.
I was hoping my red line
me on this side of the dais and you there.
Yeah. That's not lost on me.
Counselor.
Yeah.
This is very complicated, and it's certainly out of my realm of knowledge to how to really deal with this, and so I try to boil it down into something that's understandable. And so what I see is that there have been incredible delays in getting this thing resolved. So if it was real simple, it would have been already resolved. And so when a party can't get things resolved, they will sometimes come to the legislature.
Absolutely.
Because if the difficulty is terminology and definitions, and if coverage was created in the late 90s with a policy, and it's going to apply to policies, I mean, a law in the late 90s and to policies and coverage that was before 1986, then what was intended in the early 1980s may not have been clearly understood back then as to how it would apply today, okay? And for instance, the concern about about owned property.
Sure.
When it's an environmental issue, a toxic problem, maybe in the early 80s, it wasn't anticipated that this would be something that has to be dealt with today. The anti-assignment, was that clarified in the language, certainly a patent language, and if you can understand it, the court can understand that, it'll be fairly easily resolved. But if it's not, then it's a matter for litigation, and it can be drug on for many, many years. Individual counsel. That's a tough one. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, was it clarified in the original policies that the insurance company had the right to hire anybody who was certified to be a lawyer, regardless of their capacity to deal with multi-million-dollar, $100 million litigation? And so it seems to me that what we're being asked to do, at least partially, is to clarify terms that may not have been clear in the early 80s when the policies were created because of circumstances that have developed 20, 30 years later, and that ultimately the Supreme Court is going to look at what is done here and then say, no, you've gone beyond what your scope was as legislators to essentially by this legislature define what our intent should have been had we been more thorough back when, in late 90s or whatever, whenever these things were done. Can you help understand where, isn't that really what this is all about?
Chair Holvey, Representative Richardson, I'd like to be one of those lawyers who said when we would ask a question toward the end of their time, and it's a hard question, they'd say, I'm sorry, Your Honor, my red light's on. I'm just kidding. I I agree with you in trying to clarify that. It is difficult. The point I was raising here is the interpretive exercise for contracts, as you very well know, starts first, are the words not ambiguous? Because if they're not ambiguous, the law is that defines the intent of the parties. And that you see how this gets in the way of trying to figure that out. That's one of the difficulties with this bill. I think you've got a great insight into what this is. I agree with the noble purpose that we're all here for. It's just that when you have cases that have already decided the intent of the parties, I don't know how you go about then saying that's not the intent of the parties.
Just one final thing, of course, and that is, every case that you saw had two sides.
Yes.
And those on one side may well have said, I can't see why you would not agree with us on our side. But then the other side says, Your Honor, I am here. I show up. You know?
I agree completely. And I greatly respect Ms. Snyder. She's entitled to disagree. One of the things I was very careful to point out, I wasn't saying I know the answer completely to this. I was raising the concern. This is no different for all of you than the issue you've been dealing with in this building regarding PERS.
Yes.
The question that the Oregon Supreme Court, assuming that were to happen, will go through a two-step process. Is there a contract? What are its terms? And are they impaired? So in the PERS, the first question will be the big fight, is there a contract or not? And of course, you recall that I wrote the 137 pages in the Strunk case in 2005 to try to figure out what is a statutory contract in that context. Here, if you apply the Constitution and you apply the test laid out in Strunk, you would go, one, there is a contract. We're not fighting about that. Number two, at least with three of these things, we know what the terms are. The Supreme Court's already said what the terms are. They're not ambiguous. And so then the question is, are they impaired? And I think the proponents, and I agree, it's a very difficult drafting task. The opponents would like to say, well, the savings clause saved this because it says the rules don't apply. Well, if the rules don't apply, why do you have the statute? Why do you single out these three provisions that are unambiguous? And you see yourself coming and going when you do that. And the other thing is, I don't think those are rules of construction. And so it makes it for a very difficult interpretive exercise. That's all I'm saying.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And Representative Thatcher, do you have a question?
Thank you. I do. You talk about impairment of contracts, and that is something I am sensitive to, but I am also kind of puzzled because I belong to the Building Industries Association of Washington, and just kind of, you know, bringing up some different things. It's my understanding that some of these companies don't have the same issue up in Washington with the insurance. They're not, what you know, the people on the other side of the issue here. But they're not, the situation is not, well, it's not a situation up in Washington. So did Washington create such a more, you know, unambiguous law, or were policies written differently that this has not become an issue or is not now an issue up in Washington versus here?
Representative Thatcher, would you mind if I deferred to Mr. Ross Miller?
Chair Holvey and Representative Thatcher, I try to keep the answer short because I know that talking insurance makes people's eyes glaze over, and I don't blame them for that. But a key difference is that Washington has a different rules on stipulated judgments, and they don't have the Holloway case. So the Oregon Supreme Court, it happens that the Washington Supreme Court will come to a different decision than the Oregon Supreme Court would on the same thing, and the California Supreme Court may have yet another decision. That's insurance law for you. It's 50 state. Very few of the 50 states match up as an overlay one on top of the other. They all have significant differences, even ones that are quite similar. Does that help?
Thank you. I appreciate that. I really do need to move on to the next witness.
Representative Smith.
Wow.
That's a question.
You feel good about that, huh?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Appreciate it.
You weren't waving very hard over there.
Well, there's nothing like watching attorneys fight with each other. The reason, as I understand, Senate Bill 814 is being brought forward is it's to advance the cause of cleanup. And from their perspective, that's what Senate Bill 814 is going to do. Sir, if I hear you correctly, you're saying that this is not going to enhance that effort, that it's not going to speed it up, and it'll actually not result in the action that these folks are hoping to have.
Chair Halvey and Representative Smith, I agree with what you said. That is, in fact, what I'm saying.
Okay, it's so going to I want to you to be very candid with this committee. If it's not going to enhance that process, to speed it up, tell us, how is it going to slow down the process?
Well, if you look at the Chair Halvey and Representative Smith, if you look at the independent counsel provision, I disagree, but with my friend Ms. Snyder, it is not more limited than the California independent counsel rules, the so-called CUMIS statute. It is substantially broader. What it does is, the combined with the bad faith provisions, as I've mentioned in my written testimony, we're going to see a lot of litigation. This bill does not
additional litigation.
Yes, to clarify what the bill means and what are the obligations. This bill does not set definite obligations. It leaves a lot of things up in the air. So that's one thing that'll lead to additional delays. As I understood the testimony to be, there's been too much insurance litigation already. Well, get ready for rounds 3 and 4, because this bill is going to leave a lot of questions unanswered. Also, simply raising I myself do not have evidence of and haven't seen a lot of insurers hiring counsel who are completely incompetent to do a task that they're supposed to do. It is not to the insurer's benefit, because there are existing remedies under the law already. If you as an insurer hire some lawyer for $50 an hour and they mess up the case, there is a remedy against the insurance company for negligent claims handling and negligent conduct of the defense. So I don't see that happening a lot. In fact, I can't think of a single instance.
Thank you.
I have one more person to testify that signed up, Mark Nelson. And committee, before he starts, I know we have sitting in front of us a lot of legal opinions. Legislative counsel is also going to provide us a legal opinion on this issue as well. So our lawyers will be looking at it as well as the proponents and opponents. And if you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson. I'm here today representing the Oregon Mills Industry Council, which are involved with all large employers and metal manufacturers throughout Oregon. I should also indicate I also represent Allstate Insurance, who doesn't issue these kinds of policies, but you should know that. In addition, we also represent the Northwest Food Processors Association, who has a lot of interest throughout the state in this issues. First, let me say it's not the position of proponents that this bill will speed up the DEQ EPA process in making a decision. You know, in all deference to all of you in this body, no one can cause those two parties to move any faster. It will be some time, but what this bill does is, once a order has been given to clean up the harbor, it will speed up the process for moving forward. This is a very expensive process, as you begin to realize, and that's part of what this bill is about. We're not here to tell you it's going to speed up DEQ and EPA making a decision on the Portland Harbor. You know, industrial manufacturers have had experience with environmental cleanup throughout the years, but continue to encounter problems with environmental insurance claims. Part of my job back in 2003 was to pass that bill. It was, as I don't know if any of you were here then, it was a massive battle in this state. Representative Smith was here. It was friends against friends, quite honestly. It was, you know, many of us in business, of course, are very involved on the insurance side and the business side, so it really was a business against business. This legislation is modeled after legislation in Washington and California. In those states, claims are moving much faster through the process in a much more efficient manner. And results in the end, as I said, in the end, quicker cleanup time. And that's what's really key to this. Specifically, 814 would establish a reasonable timeline for handling of claims. And this is kind of patterned after the Washington law. Certainty is very important here as to how long it's going to be and how long this is going to be drawn out. You don't know in this process, even with what we passed in 2003, that whether you're in this process for the next 15 years because you've gone back and forth and back and forth into court, out of court, that's what's been occurring in this state. We need to establish guidelines with competent counsel. There are instances, contrary to the prior attorney, that have been, I believe, cataloged, in which attorneys have been hired by insurance companies who simply didn't have the very specific experience in handling these kinds of environmental claims. You don't handle these types of cases. You're going to make a lot of mistakes that attorneys who may be in practice for 10, 15 years wouldn't make if they had had some kind of environmental cleanup background. This legislation will contribute significantly to the speed by which, once the cleanup is ordered, that we move forward. Having gone through this in 2003, Mr. Chairman, it's not an easy subject, as you found out today. It's very difficult. But it's a process of trying to find some kind of middle ground that's going to stop what's been happening here in terms of the timelines and the problems that we've had year after year after year. And by the way, they aren't problems that have been happening up in Washington State, who have a very different process, and I don't think they are that different than Oregon, constitutional-wise or others. There was never a constitutional challenge to the 1999 or the 2003 statutes. The issue as to whether a public purpose is being served here, and that has been brought into question as well, I submit to you, this certainly is serving a public purpose. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony and sort of wrapping up for us. And Representative Smith.
I never ask questions.
I know you're changing my opinion.
Oh, I see. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mark, be specific with us. We just heard from the former Chief Justice of the State of Oregon, who is removed from that position less than 18 months. I don't know, but
less than that,
who called into question the constitutionality of what we're trying to advance. We heard from industry folks who said this is going to result in additional litigation. Be specific. How is this going to enhance the effort and move things forward quicker when we're hearing additional litigation is going to follow as a result of passage of this bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, I don't necessarily disagree with a previous witness that says there will be interpretations of the statute that's obviously going to end up in court. I have the greatest respect, as many of you knew, I've worked extensively with former Justice DeMunis, but he is, as he advised you at the end, he raised issues. I believe you're going to be receiving very shortly, and you do have, I believe, from Schnitzer's law firm, and a constitutional discussion of whether it violates the Constitution. I also believe you're going to see very shortly a very extensive kind of discussion of the constitutionality of that, which I think hopefully will solve that problem in your mind. And I'm not a lawyer, I can't speak to the specifics of that. So yes, there will be litigation. There has been litigation ever since the mid-90s trying to move forward on some of these claims. I mean, we have insurance policies that were issued in 1970 and ended in 86. Multiple policies.
Thank you. I think I've heard enough for today on this one.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You know, I got other people that we need to move on. I really appreciate you coming forward and giving us your testimony today. And
thank you.
That's about it for me right now on Senate Bill 814. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 814.
I have no more questions.
I was going to ask a question about the way you got treated.
Okay. I'd like to bring up Diane Lancaster briefly. I'm going to open an informational hearing. What's it on? Public alternative bidding contracting. Didn't know what you listed it as. Committee, I just briefly am bringing up Diane Lancaster, who is with DAS and is in charge of their procurement and public contractings. Just to introduce us again a little bit to more specifically public contracting in terms of lowest bid versus alternative bidding contract, setting the stage very quickly for what that is for our committee. Thank you.
You bet. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I am Diane Lancaster, the Chief Procurement Officer for the State of Oregon agencies that are served by the Department of Administrative Services. Today, I'm going to share with you very briefly information about public construction. And so a little bit of change up of topic here. It's been fascinating, of course, listening to the previous issues. We're going to talk today briefly about what's beyond the normal, what we call default standard of lowest bid in public constructions. And my little bit of outline has been delivered to you electronically, so you can look at it at your leisure. The challenges to public construction, I think, are, you know, you folks intuitively understand that any kind of public construction brings many challenges to the agencies that do the work. You're talking about a lot of money, highly visible to the public in many situations, sometimes controversial, and increasingly complex. We build a school, or we build a prison, or a mental health facility. We are, in many ways, putting a shell around technology. Technology is such a huge driver that it is definitely one of the issues that creates technical complexity. Also, there are known and unknown issues, and I put on this this little chart for you the Capitol Mall T building, which is right outside our door. Capitol Mall T building, you know, a historic building on the Capitol Mall that had to be totally gutted and rebuilt. There were so many hidden known and unknown issues in that building. It would have been difficult to deal with in any standard pattern. High penalty for failure, clearly very public, cost overruns, delays, etc., quality issues. I hate to mention the Marion County Transit District situation downtown, but it's been an eyesore here for those of us who live in Salem for many years, and a very public example of failures. And then, of course, laws and procedures, state, local, federal, you know, there's all kinds of different laws and procedures, requirements that drive challenges in construction. The current statutory policy, very clear, public improvement contracts must be based on competitive bidding, and that we call design bid build, and unless they are exempted. That is the policy of this body and has been for many years. Contracting agencies are to, by state policy, make every effort to construct public improvements at the least cost, and so that is a complementary policy. Now, there are exemptions, and the exemption process allows an agency to make a case, a justification, to its governing body. At the state, it's the Department of Administrative Services, the director. For highway construction, it is the ODOT director. And for local jurisdictions, it is the local county commission, school board, or other public governing body. When those findings are approved, then the agency, by that governing body or director, the agency must put out public notice and hold a public hearing. And the public hearing, you know, the requirements for the public hearing are laid out in statute. So that's been attended to. Now, once that exemption is granted, okay, so now what? I've laid out for you on the second page of this document, first of all, the statutory standard, the design bid build standard, and a few bullets there about sort of the, you know, the makeup of that kind of work. First of all, three processes. It is slower because of that to get to contract at least. The owner has to get a designer on board, and then after the design is set up, plans, specifications, etc., then the owner goes and gets, through competitive bidding, if a state government and local government, a builder who then builds to the design. The pros and cons are laid out for you, just a few of them. There certainly may be others that I have not put out here, but, you know, certainly it is the method favored by state policy, and certainly state agencies wish to be in compliance with state policy. It is well understood by everyone in the industry, general contractors, subcontractors, the trades, etc. The methods of handling such a contract are well established in law, and certainly the insurance, bonding, banks, you know, the entire business community understands quite well how this process works. It's chosen, of course, when it is a straightforward project. The North Capitol Mall office building happened to be one of those, and I thought that would be a nice example of a different Capitol building that was fairly straightforward and was built in this fashion. Now, the alternatives, there are two that I've mentioned specifically here. One of them, because it is the dominant subject of the Senate bill that you are going to discuss today, and this is the construction manager general contractor method. The primary difference, when you get down to it, is that when you go into an alternative method, you are going to use a request for proposal process. And what that means is you're going to set up some criteria other than price by which you will award the contract. And the CMGC, as we call it, is the classic in this area. By its nature, you know, you're hiring a firm that's going to come alongside and work as a team. You're hiring for professional expertise. You want to engage in value engineering. You're going to be looking at a project potentially that has a lot of complexity. And I can only imagine what they found when they opened up that T building, because, again, there were so many unknown issues and delicate things that they had to deal with. There are certainly pluses and minuses for this, and one of the minuses is that the owner still has to manage two contracts, still bears design risk, still has you know, issues, and there are issues around, you know, no firm price, because you're going to go with a guaranteed maximum price, but, you know, it can get dicey. The subcontractor selection process has been controversial. There's no question, I think, that there has been controversy about that.
And Diane, if you could just wrap up in the next minute or so. Senator Beyer has been patiently waiting, and I think that you have got us to where I wanted you to get us to.
Excellent. Representative,
you might as well mention the other alternatives and alternative design, just so that we know they exist.
Absolutely. And those are listed very quickly, design build, and then some other alternatives, hybrids like energy savings performance contracts, A plus B, which is a little bit of a specialty one that ODOT likes to use in highway construction. And that is the bottom line. And I'm glad that I have met the task. And please, if there are any questions now or later, glad to answer them.
Yeah, thank you. And I know you'll be around as we go through this. And you did a good job for what I was looking for, just so you know.
Thank you, sir.
Committee, I just wanted Diane to kind of tee up a little bit about the subject matter in Senate Bill 254. So with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 254A. And I'd like to have Senator Beyer, who's, you know, being patient enough to hang around for a little bit, come up and talk a little bit about his involvement or our involvement in this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, for the record, Lee Beyer. I have the pleasure of representing the Central Linn and Lane County citizens in the State Senate. And Diane just did a great job of explaining a lot of the details, and you're all still awake. It's a good thing. I just wanted to come over and introduce this. This is a bill we worked on. This was a joint effort, Representative Wisnett, Representative Hovey, and myself, coming out of the 2011 session when there was a lot of discussion about alternative methods of contracting, most specifically CMGC, and I suspect that that had the sort of the different problems of some people didn't think that some of the public contractors, the owners, were playing by the rules. And the other, in my opinion, was we had an economy where there just wasn't enough work to go around and people were not happy with the situation. But in fairness, it needed a good look. In my mind, when I looked at it, I said, there's a real transparency problem here. People don't know what's going on. Subs were getting they were bidding on projects and not knowing why they didn't get the bid. And frankly, the little competitiveness out there, some discomfort. So we recognized during the session, I think you heard, those of you who were here, heard a lot of grumbling at that time that this was not an issue that could be taken up during the session. It was a little detailed. So the three legislators created a subgroup to work on the issue, and they spent the last, since the 2011 session, working on it. I'd like to say that we were smart enough to not put ourselves in charge of the work group. We reached out, and very generously, the two lead attorneys, I think, in the state in this business from the private side, Jeremy Vermilion, and Blake Underwood from DOJ, who writes rules, co-chaired a work group that pretty much represented everybody that had an interest in the issue, from owners, public agencies, subcontractors, general contractors, and work through this. And the charge that I gave them when we started was, I don't have a desired outcome other than you come together and you come up with something that makes sense to the industry. And literally, they have worked this bill, worked this concept through, you can't believe the number of meetings and the long hours they spent working on this thing, and the product you have before you is the one that they came to. It is a consensus. I will tell you that nobody got everything they wanted. In my mind, that's good legislation, but I think we have a better bill. And for me, from my sense, is what we have is more clarity, and we have, most importantly, a good high degree of transparency, so all the participants in the process, and most importantly, the public who has an interest in a project will know exactly how the project was bid and what they're getting for their tax dollar. So that's the process, and I commend many members who spent time on that, the members of the work group. I think they did a great job, and it's nice when you see legislative work come together very well. I think you'll have an opportunity to talk to them specifically, and I will warn you that it's very detailed stuff unless you happen to be in the industry. Then it's really important to you.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Senator Beyer. I really appreciate you coming over and just laying this out for us as you've been dealing with this bill and the fruition of this work group since January, and I haven't really had my eyes on it very closely, as you can imagine. And so I just want to thank you for your continued efforts in this, and I think we're going to hear a little bit from the two co-chairs and a couple other people from the work group.
Mr. Chair, I would note that it came out of our committee with no opposition at all, and it cleared the Senate floor, I would say unanimously, but there was one excuse, but there were no votes on it. No.
And I understand that there's out there somewhere some interest in another amendment that I'm not aware of yet, but we're going to find out about it, a proposal on that.
So. Mr. Chairman, left our committee talking with the two attorneys that we hear from. There were lots of work trying to translate the industry language into legislative language. And I have some, it's one of those things we rarely see difference of opinion between the outside attorneys and LC. But there was a little of that.
And it'll never be solved totally.
Nits and bits that you may hear about. I don't think it's substantial. I think the policies that came from the Senate is the policy that I would recommend.
Yeah.
But you may see a couple of
And
points.
After the last bill and this bill, we probably won't invite attorneys to our committee anymore.
Good call.
I agree.
Good call.
Well, the two that we
except
have
the one sitting here.
We love our attorneys.
Is that a promise?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. I appreciate
it. Back to work.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate it. I'd like to have Jeremy Vermilia and Blake Underwood. And gentlemen, I appreciate you coming up and maybe letting us know where you're at. Not really perhaps the specifics of the arguments that we're going to probably entertain in a future hearing when we get into your next set of amendments, but maybe you can kind of go over what we are looking at.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Jeremy Vermilia. I am one of the co-chairs of the what has affectionately become known as the Public Contracting Work Group. With me is Blake Underwood, who also co-chaired that committee. And we're hopeful there won't be any opposition. As Senator Beyer indicated, this is a product of about a year and a half's worth of work with over 30 members of all the different angles that you could take to look at this issue. We had public owners, we had state agencies, we had counties, we had cities, we had trade associations, we had individual general contractors, we had subcontracting groups, we had individual subcontractors, we had labor, and we had lawyers. And we had members of the legislature as well. And I think it's very important to note that the both the bill that you see before you and the packet of amendments that is now currently being worked on at Ledge Council, and I have to give Blake a lot of credit for having put a lot of effort into the fine detail in this last round of amendments. That's all the product of consensus by our committee. There were some difficult policy decisions that had to be made. There were pieces that some people felt very strongly should be included that did not get included in the final outcome. But what you see before you is the product of consensus. And the agreement going into the first committee meeting that we had, in fact, was an agreement amongst everybody who participated that we were going to have consensus or we were not going to move forward. And so what you have before you is the product of that consensus. I think Ms. Lancaster and Senator Beyer did a very good job of kind of teeing this issue up. A couple of additional points I wanted to make besides the sort of the general overview was, you know, to reiterate that our charge was to review current law and identify areas of that law that may need adjustment in both the exemption process as well, and that is the process that, as Ms. Lancaster talked about, the process where you go from the default policy of design, bid, build, competitive bidding to one of these alternative methods. So charge number one, look at that process, make sure that it is being done correctly by state and local and special districts to ensure that we make sure it's fair, it's transparent, that it's meeting the legislative language that is currently in effect, and see if there's anything that needs to be done to adjust that. Second thing we looked at very closely was the selection within the CMGC process. Okay, so you go from the very broad all contracts, all public projects, to those projects that are exempted from the process of competitive bidding to where the agency selects CMGC as the delivery method, the type of contract they're going to use. Within that box, we looked at the process of selecting both prime contractors and subcontractors and looked at ways in which we can improve that, because it became apparent to us in the weeks and months leading up to the formation of the formal committee, as well as in the early stages of the committee, that where a lot of the problems arise with respect to CMGC in particular is the perception that it is not a fair process, that essentially the fix is in. We don't all agree that that is in fact the case, but there certainly are some perceptions out there. And so the idea was, how do we come up with a process that where we can increase public confidence to ensure transparency, to ensure fairness, to ensure that everyone has their opportunity to partake of public monies in the public contracting context. And so that is really what those two big picture areas are what we focused on as a group. Ultimately, we made two significant modifications to the existing law with numerous subparts that I don't think we want to get into today, particularly because the amendments are still outstanding. So I'm not going to get into that level of detail, but I do want to talk in very broad measure, and Blake can fill in the areas that I'm sure I will have missed. One, the idea is to modify the exemption process to ensure that a deviation from the low bid policy is truly necessary and supported by real findings of fact by the public body, and we beefed up essentially that exemption process pretty substantially. It's going to be a heavier load now for an agency to exempt themselves from hard bid, design bid build work, and that is by design. And these changes now apply to all forms of alternative contracting. The second was to modify the CMGC selection process, both with respect to general contractors and subcontractors, to make that process more transparent. We have things that we are requiring agencies to do in terms of notifying parties when they have the right to an interview post-selection. We have modified the process in terms of what kinds of things that they can and cannot ask in the interview process or in the selection process. And we spent a lot of time on that particular issue. And we have made it so that when contractors hire their subcontractors, and this was a real source, it was one of the major sources of consternation, frankly, in the process. We've placed requirements that will go into the prime contract and require the prime contractor to implement as part of their subcontract measures to ensure that subcontractors are given a fair shot at the work, that they are notified when a selection has been made for their particular specialty area, that they are given the opportunity for post-selection interviews so they can essentially ask contractors what their strengths and weaknesses were in terms of how they presented their proposal, their bid, et cetera. The idea, again, is to try to foster improved public confidence in the process and to alleviate some of the perceptions about the CMGC process. I think it's important to note that we went into this not with the idea that we would abolish CMGC, nor with the idea that we would make CMGC sort of the law of the land or a non-alternative. The idea was not to make changes of that magnitude. The idea was to recognize that CMGC, along with other alternative procurement methods, is a valuable and important way in which to procure public contracting work, but to make sure that that process works correctly, the way it was intended when the process was originally written into law, 20 years ago. So again, I want to reiterate, the committee met for a very long time. The decisions were consensus-based. The bill and amendments that have been drafted are the product of that consensus. And I know that we're in hearing, but I think I would, and I think Blake and the other members of the committee that are here would respectfully request that until we get the amendments out of Ledge Council, that we do nothing to the bill now, because I think if we do that, it will just create confusion, and we don't want to have that. To the extent that there are folks that want to add to the bill or change things in the bill, I think that's fine, but I think we want to wait to have those kinds of conversations or make decisions like that until we actually get those amendments back. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Underwood.
Chair Hurley, members of the committee, I'm Blake Underwood. I'm with the General Counsel Division, Department of Justice. I am with a specialty unit of lawyers that are expert in transactional work. My specific expertise is in design and construction contracting, and I've been with practiced in 15 years prior to coming to the state in 2000, and then I've worked in that area since that time. I've been involved in the regular development of the model rules. I was part of a work group that was a little bit larger than the one associated with the 254, but a work group associated with the public contracting code, developing the public contracting code. And on the design and construction side, my responsibility was on the design contract side with my colleague Dana Anderson helping with the construction side. But I was integrally involved in the sort of C side, the construction side of the code. And so I had have that significant background, and that's one of the reasons why I was asked to participate in this group. I'd like to say that in response to Chair Holvey's comments, that there are troublesome lawyers, and then there's Jeremy and I, who are just here to help. I'd like to...
Might be something behind that comment, obviously.
Lawyers until you need one.
As Jeremy mentioned, we had a very large group of stakeholders in the committee proper. I'd like to also mention that we were fairly generous. The meetings were open to the public, and we were very generous to allow other industry reps, other public owner reps who regularly attended these meetings, and when it was at all possible, which was most of the time, we allowed them to participate and offer comments to the group. So we had a very extensive level of participation by anyone who was really interested in the process. Senator Beyer made a very good comment earlier that there was some bumps in the road in conveying the language that the work group developed and with Ledge Council. And I think that's understandable in this particular context because it's fairly complicated legislation that is specific to a particular industry. So we had all these experts on the work group. We had several lawyers involved in the work group. We had not only Diane Lancaster, but Tom Lauer and other very experienced members of agencies who have been involved in the development of legislation in the past. So we had some folks that were very conscious of the way the code needs to look. So we went through a very large number of drafts, 10 to 15 drafts on the CMGC procurement side, 7 or 8 drafts on the exemption side, and in both of those statutes, there's a kind of a third category that this bill addresses, and that is the model rules. There are some specific adjustments in the 279A065, which deals with the model rules, which gives direction about how the CMGC model rules are to be developed for consistency. The hope was, because there have been issues and problems with different agencies developing different processes for CMGC, folks feeling like they've been left out of that process, there was a very strong desire for consistency, and one of the ways that was to be accomplished was to address some provisions in the model rules to say we're going to develop a model method for doing CMGC contracting, and we want all the public agencies to use that method. So that's a third sort of component of what we're talking about. That's enough of that. Again, I want to be helpful, not one of those troublesome lawyers. The other thing I we wanted to do today is very late in the process on the Senate side, the work group very quickly developed a list of final sort of fine-tuning adjustments that the work group felt were necessary to implement the sort of the intent of all the participants. And I put together a summary after receiving comments from the work group. I submitted that summary on the Senate side. I have reworked that summary of recommended edits for this committee, and I have adjusted it to focus on the A engrossed version of the bill so that would be easier for you to follow. So I'm happy to take questions on those edits, but I believe it's probably premature for that, but I'm happy to, if folks are curious, I'm happy to do that.
Yeah, you're correct. It is premature for us to talk about those edits and the amendments at this point. I do want to start getting your final edits drafted, so we do need to coordinate with that. But I want to caution the committee from getting too much into these edits until we actually get the language back from Legislative Council. But at least you can see where they're headed ahead of time. And I wanted to get a few more people that wanted to that were on the committee to speak. And in case you have anything else to add, I think you did a great job of meeting my intent of having you here and laying out the process and what this was about before we actually get into looking at this the amendments to this particular bill.
Can I ask one
Representative Kenny Geyer.
It seems like you're the appropriate panel, so thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Can you say anything about how you may have looked at intentional consequences or possibly unintentional consequences for minority women, emerging small business subcontractors, contractors?
Sure. Chair Holvey, Representative Kenny Geyer. The work that we did not touch on any of those issues, and the reason for that is basically that the minority women, emerging small business, set-aside programs, et cetera, are dealt with in other sections of the law. Mm-hmm. But we certainly talked a lot about the issue and considered the issue of in particular, when you get into CMGC, how do you deal with the question of ensuring that if an agency has a particular goal in mind for a percentage level for the number of minority or women-owned businesses that they want to see hired on a particular project, how does that process get accounted for in the process? And the answer is it essentially comes down to what an agency decides are the criteria by which it wants to select a contractor. So you have certain minority hiring requirements, and there are very few types of projects where those are in place, and they are constitutionally, you can't set quotas unless you've gone through a disparity study and some other processes that the courts have laid down. And for example, ODOT on certain projects lays out a percentage. That's a hard goal.
Mm-hmm.
And there are two or three categories of minorities which apply. So that's one sort of category. And then you have the more aspirational goals. And these range from 8% for one agency to 10% for another agency to 15% for another agency, and there are different factors. So bottom line is nothing in this bill changes anything that is in current practice. Those things are addressed as part of selecting a contractor. A contractor will have to respond to what an agency's goals are, meet their good faith obligations, etc., and none of that will change as a result of this bill.
And I might add that Cheryl Myers from the governor's office was a regular attendee in these work group meetings, so that was something that was that we were watching very closely, and the governor's office was as well.
Okay.
Thank you so much, gentlemen. I'm bet you're just looking forward to this bill finally being done, and I just want to thank you.
Oh, then we get to start with rulemaking.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to thank you so much for getting us this far. So, I'd like to have Tom Girding and Brian Smith.
Design bill, not design.
And I saw you come in late, Mr. Krieg. Did you want to?
Yeah, they throw the bid in there.
No, you're fine.
Yeah.
Okay. And we have just a few minutes left for each of you. Thank you for being here and giving us your perspective on this process and this bill. Could you introduce yourself for the record?
Okay. Chairman and committee members, my name is Tom Girding, and wearing several hats here today. I'm a downstate contractor down in Corvallis, owner of Girding Companies. We are both a general contractor, and I also have a group that does specialty work as a subcontractor, a medium-sized contractor. Additionally, I was a member of the work group that has been spoken about. And then finally, I'm also here as the current AGC president. In AGC, we have about 900 members statewide, very diverse group of industry professionals and contractors and subcontractors, open shop union, so a large, small, very, very diverse group. I'm really glad to be here. It's been a long process working through all this over, think about the past 18 months, and what we need, and again, it's been spoken very well through Diane and through Jeremy and Blake, and so I won't belabor it, but from an industry standpoint, better transparency, fairness, and consistency, I think probably speaks best to it in when an public owner wants to use the CMGC process. And when I say that, we're talking about all public owners. it wasn't overly abused, but it seemed like a lot of the times when there was challenges where we heard from members and different ones, it's from the smaller public entities and those that aren't engaged in contracting on a day-to-day, month-to-month basis. It's they may have a school bond levy, and that occurs every 10 years and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So we support Senate Bill 254 as a great first step. It truly does, working through it all, improve transparency. And in the owner's initial exemption process, as well as once the CMGC works through that basis, the selection process, utilizing a consistent set of model rules, that is probably one of the largest pieces from the contracting side that's brought to this, because within that, that's really where in the selection process of both the CMGC as well as the subcontractors, the transparency and consistency and fairness and all of those things work through. And I guess the last thing I'll say is having worked through the work group, it really was a large, diverse group of large GCs down to smaller GCs, the trades, the labor side, the public owners of all the varieties, everything working through. And there was a, this is a complex complex issue, and there was lots of debate and negotiation and working through all of that by the time we are to where we are today, just about every issue was vetted. One thing I would bring up is that NAMCA was there, the National Minority Association, and so they had a seat at the table. Additionally, as Blake Underwood noted, the gallery, so while there was a large group that showed up month in, month out, also the gallery was wide open to whoever wanted to show up, and the co-conveners very much engaged them. So really industry-wide, this thing got vetted very well. And I think in summation, nobody got exactly what they wanted, and I think that's the process of a mediation when it ends up that nobody's ecstatic. From our standpoint, we didn't get everything we wanted, but we can we see this as a great first step, and I think there's probably consensus amongst everybody that this is a good first step, and not everybody. In fact, I don't think anybody got everything they wanted. And again, that's part of a negotiation. So wrapping it up, I think it is a very good bill for our industry. And simply stated, it's good public policy.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman.
I really appreciate your involvement and your testimony today. I've got a few minutes left for Mr. Smith. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
I'll be very brief. My name is Brian Smith, Chair Hulvey, representatives, and I'm the purchasing manager for Multnomah County, and I also was a member of the team that put this bill together to bring to you. And I'll be very brief. I just wanted to say that I think I would echo the sentiments about nobody got everything they want, and I think everybody left the room feeling like, this is something I can live with. So I think for public agencies, the key for me was that this is an important tool for public agencies to use appropriately. It's not something that should be used all of the time, but in those instances where it is appropriate, it's a very important tool that helps us address quite a wide variety of issues for complex projects. The bill as it's written really does increase the transparency, and I think by making the compromise, and this was one of the things the public agencies didn't get, but by having to go with the model rules, I think really levels the playing field for making public agencies owners of different sizes using the same rules, I think for industry, really kind of levels things out. And I think that's a very strong thing, even though it's something that, for my agency in particular, that is something we're giving up on. But it's As we move forward, I think that the flexibility that this tool provides, that this method provides, and Representative Kenegar, to your point, the we've actually, in the last two CMGC projects Multnomah County has done, we've actually been able to, we believe, get better utilization outcomes working in partnership, mm-hmm. in negotiation with the selected CMGC around MWSB utilization. Mm-hmm. So for some projects that it's appropriate for, it really is a very powerful tool to have in the toolkit. So with that, I'll say thank you very much and take any questions.
Thank you. Really, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate what you're saying about various sizes of agencies being able to benefit from greater clarity and so forth. You know, for instance, at the school district level, you know, you may do a construction bond once every 10, 12 years or whatever. They're not, mm-hmm. it's not something they do frequently. So the more clarity there can be about the process is very helpful for everybody. But also, you know, CMGC is such a good alternative for people who don't routinely do that kind of work also. You partner with someone else who can provide some of the expertise. You develop that relationship, that kind of bond, if you will, and together you get the project done on time, often at a lesser price than if you're simply going to go out and let's go for the low bid right off the bat, but we really don't know what we're asking for, and then you get into other extrapolating things that happen because you didn't think about this or that and so forth. So I appreciate what you guys have done, and I think it's a good bill, and I hope we can get this thing wrapped up quickly.
Thank you.
Thank you. I just add in the last 30 seconds, Representative Johnson, because you do bring up a point that I know that the work group did talk about how the state and or, you know, and other entities could help some of the smaller local governments get through understanding how this process should work and understanding how to do it correctly. And I think that we're still talking about how do we get those resources to the smaller local governments and local districts to help them understand how to use this tool, because it's a valuable tool.
Yeah. Just to say, having been the project manager for Oregon Solutions for the Vernonia Schools Project, it's a great case in point.
Thank you. Thank you very much for all your work, all your testimony, and taking the time out to educate us on this bill. And I saw Mr. Lauer there. Did you want to say anything?
Thanks.
Just wanted to be there in case we had a question about A plus B. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 254A. And I will adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency. Okay.